Yes, so today I'm going to talk on the relationship between discrete structures and continuous structures, and that will lead us to a branch of mathematics, so-called sampling theory, which has applications that span a wide range of fields, from the recording of music, for example, to cosmology even. So here's the problem that I'd like to address. Sometimes we're given a discretely defined function. It occurs in some of our calculations, and we might find it easier, we would wish perhaps, if that it was a continuous function like this. And why would we wish that? Well, for example, we may have to sum over f, and to work out sums, especially infinite sums, is generally speaking a little bit more difficult than working out integrals. So if instead of having a sum we had an integral, that might be easier to deal with. So it would be nice to take this discrete structure here and replace it by a continuous one. Here's an example. This is from number theory. It's part of, appears in the proof of an equation by Ramanujan. Here we have this sum, and it looks a little bit unwieldy. I mean, how can we manipulate this thing? How can we evaluate that? Wouldn't it be nice if instead we had some integral to evaluate? And it turns out, yes, we can do that. It is possible to rewrite this as an integral in this form. And you see right away that this is much easier to handle. You know, you get immediately ideas. Well, maybe I try some substitution here, perhaps integration by parts and so on. You can't do that with the sum. So that would be an instance where we start with a discrete structure that we're given, and we'd really like to have something continuous. Or conversely, we might be given a continuous function, and as the case may be, we may actually wish that we had a discrete function instead, a discretely defined function instead. Because, for example, we may have to count something, and we can't count the values of t if they are taken out of the real numbers, for example, but we can count the integers. And a very important example occurs in information theory. And for those of you who may not know, information theory is a field that was essentially founded in one big push by Claude Shannon in the 1940s. And he wrote this book, The Mathematical Theory of Communication. Now, if the New York Times counts for something, in the year 2000, they published a list of what they think is a list of some of the most influential books of the 20th century. And even though that book is not all that well-known, perhaps, it is apparently one of the most influential that was written in the past century. And that's because, you know, it really defined what we mean by information, how we measure it, how we transform it, how we communicate it, and so on. Now, the information theory distinguishes between two kinds of information, discrete and continuously represented information. As far as discrete sources of information are concerned, it might look like that. That might be the output of a discrete source of information, of a source of discrete information. And we know nowadays how easy it is to quantify how much information is in there. It basically reduces to counting bits and bytes, although it's, of course, more complicated than that, but roughly speaking. But then in the 1940s already, Shannon recognized that the situation is somewhat more complicated when you're dealing with a continuous source of information, such as a music recording. Right, so this might be here this is the pressure in the y-axis, and that's the time, and that would be the recording. This would be what happens when somebody plays an instrument. You get this kind of a curve here. And that's certainly not a discrete structure. And it would seem that there is an infinite amount of information in there. In fact, it would seem that if we want to record that digitally, we would have to record the amplitude at an uncountable number of points on the time axis. So it would seem that there is generically an infinite amount of information in there, and we would, even if we know the function f of t, the pressure as a function of t, even if we know that function, we would usually probably wish we had a discrete function, and so that we have only to record a discrete number of amplitudes. So Shannon faced this question: is there an uncountable amount of information in the piece of music? Nowadays, of course, we know the answer. You know, you can have a perfectly fine recording of a Beethoven symphony, and it's only a few megabytes. So how come? And I will come back to this, how Shannon actually was able to solve that particular problem here. Well, so far we had an example of where we were given a discrete structure in this number theoretic sum, and we would have wished it to be continuous. Here we have continuous functions, and we would prefer dealing with discrete functions so that we can count information. Sometimes, and now I'm moving to a different field, sometimes we don't even know whether what we are dealing with is discrete or continuous. And that appears in mathematical physics. The problem can even be that we don't know whether what we're dealing with is discrete or continuous, and an example would be space-time itself. How does space-time really look like? If we look at it with a microscope, with an extremely good microscope, a microscope much better than the microscopes that we have nowadays, in principle, we would expect that it's just perhaps a differentiable manifold. So continuous, certainly. One would think so. But it's not a trivial question. In fact, a large part of the mathematical physics community nowadays discusses the possibility that space-time ultimately might just be something discrete, which means that the set of space of points in space might be countable rather than having the properties of the continuum. And the argument that leads us to suspect that this might be the case, or at least raises the question, goes back to Heisenberg and is at least 60, 70 years old. If you take together quantum theory and general relativity, then you run into this following line of reasoning here. If we want to know whether space is really a continuum or perhaps discrete, we ought to take a microscope and resolve and look very closely at what we see. Now, a red light microscope is not as good as a blue light microscope because blue light has more power and more energy in it. And this is a simulation of what happens in a particle accelerator. A particle accelerator you can think of as a microscope. It's just higher energetic particles than higher energetic than blue light. But that's what they do here. And now, what does it mean that we use such a microscope to resolve small distances? It means that position uncertainties are getting smaller and smaller. And then there's this simple argument. Some of you, I hope, are familiar with the uncertainty relation, or have heard of Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. What it means is that if I make position measurement more and more precise, I try to resolve things very precisely, then automatically the momentum uncertainty must increase. But momentum, just like energy, is curving space. It's producing a non-trivial curvature tensor. So if there is a momentum, if the momentum uncertainty is increasing, as I ramp up the power of my microscope, the momentum uncertainty is increasing, it means that ultimately I'm starting to get a significant uncertainty in the curvature of space. But if on a manifold I have two points and I don't quite know what the curvature is in between, I don't really know how far they are from how far they are apart from another. And that means that even though I started out making very precise distance measurements, I run into an obstacle here, because eventually I get such large curvature uncertainties that I can't really determine a distance very precisely. And that's why it has long been suspected, more than half a century, that there is a smallest, best resolution that one can possibly achieve with any kind of microscope, because quantum theory and general relativity are so fundamental. Checking the orders of magnitude, we expect that this happens at 10 to the minus 35 meters. So if space-time is a continuum, then we won't see anything happening at 10 to the minus 35 meters. But if it is indeed discrete, see, the idea is that if we can't resolve distances smaller than 10 to the minus 35 meters, maybe that's the spacing between the discrete points. Not very convincing, perhaps, but it's a possibility. Right? And a lot of people are considering it. I personally don't think that it's the case, but it's kind of unnatural. But it's not excluded. The theory allows for it. However, it seems that we are not going to know anytime soon whether the set of space-time points is countable or whether it has the properties of a continuum, because our best microscopes can resolve only 10 to the minus 18 meters. These are the big accelerators. And you see, this is 17 orders of magnitude away, so that's basically 17 orders of magnitude in dollars as well. So we are not going to measure that anytime soon this way. Okay, so the question is, given this argument, could space still be continuous? String theory researchers might tell you, yes, sure, it could still be continuous. But then others would say, no, it has to be discrete. Loop quantum gravity people, for example, would say that this is the case. Well, then there's also, there are other possibilities. One of them might be that space, the set of space points might have a cardinality between that of the natural numbers and the continuum. Could it be? I mean, who knows? What it actually is, what the structure of space-time is at very small distances, whether it is something continuous or discrete or in between, that's one of the deepest problems in mathematical physics. Let's look at this one a little bit more closely here, just for a moment, just for fun. It's that's a fun thing to think about. Could it be that space-time is a set, the set of points in space has a cardinality between discrete and continuous, between countable and the continuum? Well, many of you probably know the history of it, but it's a fun topic. So let me just briefly review it. Cantor, of course, was one of the first to really understand that there are different kinds of infinity. And in 1877, he came up with this continuum hypothesis, which is to say that there is no set which would have an intermediate cardinality between the countable infinite and the continuum. Hilbert recognized that this is a very important problem and listed it in the year 1900 as the first of his list of problems for the 20th century, hoping that somebody would find out either way, it is true or it is not true in the course of the 20th century. Well, Gödel and Cohen figured it out, but they didn't prove that it is true, the hypothesis, or that it is false. They proved that it is neither true nor false. Because conventional set theory, Semmel or Frankel set theory, is just incomplete. And it turned out, as Gödel and Cohen showed, that you can add an axiom to set theory that claims that there is such a set of intermediate cardinality, but equally well, you might add an axiom claiming that there isn't. So it's up to you, really. And you can't prove it from set theory. Now, the implications for mathematical physics are that if you want to describe space as being a set of intermediate cardinality, then you have to go beyond set theory, beyond conventional set theory, and that is thought to be unlikely, but who knows? Anyway, so the question arises, is there any possibility of relating discrete structures and continuous structures somewhat more easily? Is there not the simpler way of relating discrete and continuous structures than to have to go to the very foundations of set theory? And there is a simpler way of connecting discrete and continuous structures. There was a key breakthrough that Shannon made in the 1940s when he was faced with the question of how to quantify how much information is there in a music recording. It seemed to be infinite, but it was kind of obvious that you can do a good recording. So he solved that problem. And the way he established the connection between the discrete and continuous was that he recognized the significance of the so-called sampling theorem, which is often named after him, but he didn't actually come up with it first. He only recognized its importance. So he succeeded in reducing the continuous sources of information case to the case of discrete sources of information. Now here I'm listing, so here I will now describe the basic sampling theorem, the simplest version of sampling theorem. It spawned a whole theory, sampling theory, and there are conferences on just on sampling theory and so on. So I'm just giving you the simplest sampling theorem. It's often credited, often Shannon is credited for it, but that's not really right. He only discovered the significance of it. And if you ask a Swedish person, they would say that Nyquist would have to be named before him. But then, in fact, if you ask a Russian, he will say that this is the person who was first. And the theorem is so important that many others are said to have been very much involved, Whittaker. And now we are at Borel, 1880s, who probably wrote down something like the sampling theorem. And then, now this is this is getting into the prehistory of things. Cauchy didn't actually write down the sampling theorem as such, but he seemed to have gotten the idea of it. And that claim is based on some letters that survived, letters that he wrote to somebody. So let's just put all the initials, all the names here together. Okay, so the basic sampling theorem states the following. Assume that a function possesses what is called a finite bandwidth. which means in the case of a music signal that it does not contain frequencies beyond a certain range. Let's call this frequency W max. W for the frequency and W max for the maximum frequency. It means concretely that we can write this music signal, this function f of t, f of time, as a linear combination of those fixed frequency exponentials with frequencies W ranging from minus W max to plus W max, multiplied with the strength with which this frequency occurs in that signal. Of course, I could write this in terms of sine and cosines, but it's a more compact notation using the complex exponential here. So the assumption is that your signal is of this form. So it does not have any Ws, it doesn't have any frequencies beyond some maximum frequency. Then the conclusion of the theorem is that this function can be fully reconstructed if you know only its discrete samples at discrete points in time. And you see, this is an equality sign here, which is quite amazing. It's not an approximation. It's an equality here. So if our music recording doesn't contain frequencies above 22 kilohertz, which is the case in hi-fi recording. You see, if the band plays, if the orchestra plays, there may be frequencies above 22 kilohertz, but in the recording studio, they pass it through a filter just to make sure that it doesn't contain any frequencies above, so that they can then apply the theorem. So the theorem says that you can actually reconstruct that function at all times t, just from knowing what that function is at discrete points in time. And those discrete points are n over 2 W max, n running through all the integers, negative and positive integers. And here's a function of t and tn, which is a so-called reconstruction kernel. So think of this as the music, the pressure function over time. And what we do here is we take discrete samples, so the spacing is 1 over W max. And what the theorem tells us is that it suffices to record the amplitude of the music signal at those discrete points in time, store those numbers on the CD, which is actually being done, and then your CD player will be able to reconstruct the original function even between the sample points without an error. So your CD player is not actually, you know, putting straight lines from point to sample point to sample point. It's in effect doing this, and is in principle able to reconstruct the original function completely. So that means that if your function obeys a band limitation, has a bandwidth, then you have actually reduced it to the discrete case. So you have actually reduced the case of a continuous source of information to the case of a discrete source of information. This must be one of the most applied theorems ever, because it's all over anything to do with digital signal analysis. So the application of that theorem was immediate in information theory. It's the crucial link between the discrete and continuous representation of information, as I just said, and it is the reason why music can be stored on CDs. But it's not restricted to music. It's speech, scientific data taking. If you have some instrument that gives you some continuous output, if you know that it has a bandwidth, then you know that you can reconstruct if you only take sufficiently densely spaced samples. It's also applied in two and three dimensions. You can apply it to imaging and even to video. Well, does it do the trick of transforming integrals to sums? Yeah, in a certain way it does. If your function is band limited, then indeed this integral here can be expressed as this sum. Or conversely, that sum can be expressed as this integral up to some constant prefactor, as we can show as a corollary of the sampling theorem. And that, in fact, has been used, I'm told. I'm not a number theorist myself, but I've been told that this has been used occasionally in number theory. Then let's ask, you know, we had these three areas of the application: information theory, where we have things that are continuous, we wish them to be discrete. We had number theory, where we have discrete things that we may wish to be continuous. And now let's ask, again, in this situation where we ask, is space actual physical space, is that discrete or continuous? And we don't know what it is. Could it be that space has just those properties, which would mean it has this sampling property? You see, it would be elegant in a way because it would combine the properties of discreteness and continuity. You see, music is, of course, a continuous signal, and yet you completely capture it if you just record it at discrete points. So maybe that's also the situation in nature with all the fields out there. Just a possibility, but let's consider it for the moment. It would mean that the finite maximal resolution, Heisenberg's argument, would mean, that's just a pure conjecture, which would have to be checked in experiment, it would mean that there is a generalized bandwidth, something like a maximum frequency, a shortest wavelength in nature. If so, if there really is a shortest wavelength in nature, if that's what Heisenberg's argument means, well, then it means that electric fields, magnetic fields, and all the other fields would be reconstructible everywhere if we know the amplitudes only at the discrete set of sufficiently densely spaced points, and the points may have to be spaced at a distance of 10 to the minus 35 meters. But the point is, you don't have to choose a particular set of discrete points. Any set of discrete points would be good as long as the spacing is fine. Just the same with the music. It doesn't really matter at which exact points in time you record the music, as long as the spacing is dense enough. And what would it mean? It would mean that in nature, information can be represented only up to a certain maximum density. If you want to record some information in a physical representation, no matter what matter you choose to represent your information, you cannot compress it to more than basically a bit per 10 to the minus 35 meters squared. To the third power cubed. As I said, this is unlikely to be tested with accelerators. There are 17 orders of magnitude between what we can test and where we expect an effect might appear. But actually, and this is what gets me to cosmology, it turns out that there is a slight chance that one might just test whether space is really having the properties of the continuum or perhaps it's a countable set. Namely, in the past few years, it has turned out that a certain theory of cosmology is extremely successful. And what this theory says is that the Big Bang acted as the ultimate microscope, really, because the expansion was so fast, in fact, exponential, initially of the universe shortly after the Big Bang, that even the tiniest quantum fluctuations are ubiquitous, they're always around us. But normally they're so small, you can just about measure them in the lab. But the point is that, according to modern cosmology, the expansion of the universe initially was so rapid and so dramatic that it would have stretched out those tiny quantum fluctuations to cosmological size, where they played an important role. Those quantum fluctuations are supposed to have seeded the condensation of the primordial hydrogen into galaxies. So in fact, the structure that you see around us, the distribution of galaxies, the distribution of matter, ultimately the distribution of us, originates in those tiny quantum fluctuations that have been stretched to enormous size. It sounds like an outrageously outlandish idea, and 20 years ago it was, of course. Let me show you what they predicted 20 years ago. I mean, there were many competing theories about how structure came about in the universe. And this particular theory called cosmic inflation, there was a big conference in Toronto about it just 2 months ago. What they predicted 20 years ago was that if you plot the amount of fluctuations, the statistics of fluctuations over the scale of the fluctuation, of the angular scale, so that's basically a statistical distribution of energy and matter in the universe, according to the idea that they arise from quantum fluctuations, and this is what you predict. And this is what was measured in 2003, not just by one experiment, but by many. Satellite-based telescopes were the best, and you see, it's really a pretty good match. It's quite amazing. And all the other theories are way off. They predict completely other stuff. So that's pretty amazing. Yes, this is error bars.
So those are error bars.
That's right. Yeah, those are error bars. And in particular, those features, this is really something that's pretty convincing, I think. Okay, so now, according to that theory, even the tiniest things were blown up to cosmological size. And, you know, the prediction was there before the measurements. That's really significant. Okay, now, more. So this is the earliest, measurement of the distribution of energy and matter in the universe. It's a picture of the cosmic microwave background. And that's an actual image. I mean, this is just the heat radiation that you see in the background in the sky. And future experiments will resolve this at a much better scale, and it will also resolve the polarization of it and so on. And now we know that even 10 to the minus 35 meters, even such small scale, should have been expanded to cosmological size. And therefore, there's quite a lot of literature out there now which proposes that if we measure this distribution of energy and matter in the universe only precisely enough, we might just see an imprint of what space-time really looks like at 10 to the minus 35 meters. We see the smallest by looking at the largest. It's quite paradoxical, but this is how it is nowadays. And we might therefore just see an imprint of either the continuity of space-time or its discreteness, some graininess, as some people suggest. Basically, you see the pixels. If you enlarge an image significantly, then eventually you see the individual pixels. That's what some people suggest. I don't believe so, that you see the pixels. But there was actually an article in the New York, Scientific American, saying a pixelated universe. I don't believe it, but it's a possibility. But then there are other possibilities, and one of them would be that we see the effect of a finite bandwidth, that there is a finite smallest wavelength, essentially, or the imprint of that would be seen in there if you look at sufficient resolution. In any case, it's something that might be possible within the next 5 to 10 years or so. Several satellite missions are being planned. Okay, but now it's time to prove the sampling theorem. I went through those three applications in number theory, in information theory, and in cosmology. Now, let's prove the basic sampling theorem. The basic sampling theorem is easy to prove, so I give you the proof. Of course, sampling theory as a field has a lot of sampling theorems, and they use a lot of different kinds of mathematics, far beyond Fourier theory, but for the basic sampling theorem, basic Fourier theory is sufficient. Let's remember the Fourier transform. So f of t and f tilde of w are a Fourier transform pair. Which means, let me just remind you that if f of t is, a pressure function of time, a music signal, then f tilde of w tells you how much of the frequency w is present in that signal, because what we're doing here is we are decomposing the signal into a linear combination of those fixed frequency oscillations. And in this Fourier transform, we allow for all frequencies to occur, and it ranges over the entire time axis as well. Okay, so that is true for any kind of signal, whether it is now band limited or not. It may have arbitrarily high frequencies present. Now, the situation is different if we assume that our function is band limited, that our signal is band limited. Band limited, remember, means that there's a maximum frequency. It doesn't contain frequencies higher than a certain maximum frequency, which means that f tilde, the Fourier transform, the signal in Fourier space, is zero whenever the frequency is larger than the maximum frequency. In this case, we have a function which has a compact support in the frequency domain, which means that we can apply the Fourier series rather than Fourier transform. We can still apply Fourier transform to it, of course, but we can also apply Fourier series now. And we find that the Fourier transform of our function can be represented as a Fourier series. So we now only need those discrete exponentials. And here are the Fourier coefficients. The Fourier coefficients are calculated simply in this, you know, it's an inner product between the Fourier transform of the function and those fixed frequency exponentials. We notice now that those Fourier coefficients Cn are in fact related to the function at the point at fixed point in time. Just compare those two equations here, and you see that they are pretty much the same. You're integrating over f tilde. You're having the same Fourier factor here, the same exponential, except that t takes those values n over 2 w max. And therefore, we can identify, and then there's the prefactor of 1 over 2 w max. Therefore, we can identify that those Fourier coefficients of the Fourier series, Cn, are just those numbers. where we defined Tn, so the T values here, which correspond to those values here, we defined them like this. Therefore, we can write the Fourier series by plugging this expression for Cn into here. We obtain this formula here for the Fourier series, which expresses the Fourier transform of our function in terms of what this function does at discrete points in time, multiplied with these frequency factors. Now, we are nearly done. We only have to plug this f tilde of w, this expression for it, into that formula over here. Let's do this. And we obtain that f of t is this. So this was our f of w. It turns out that we can interchange the sum and the integral, and we end up with this expression here, where, very nicely, this here can be integrated out. You see, there's no w dependence anywhere here. So we can integrate this thing out. It's a very easy to carry out integral. It just gives us a sign, essentially, over a w, over some prefactors. And carrying out this integral, we arrive, indeed, at the sampling formula, at the basic sampling theorem, saying that the function at all real points in time can be calculated from knowing just what the function does at discrete points in time if we sum over all n and multiply with this kernel here. That's, of course, a function of the type sine x over x, which goes like, you know, like this. It decays like 1 over t, which means that f of t at a particular point time at a particular point in time is mostly dependent on the nearby sampling points, of course, because the sampling kernel then decays away after a while. Okay, so that's the that was the basic sampling theorem. Now, generalized sampling theorems, there are plenty of them. Some of them just developed for the heck of it. I mean, you can prove it or prove it, and it's just it's also, I mean, basically it's ranging into, it's become its own discipline, but also some of it has been driven by applications in engineering, of course. And in any case, Fourier theory basically never suffices to prove a more general sampling theorem, and lots of branches of mathematics get involved when you work on sampling theory, harmonic analysis, of course, but then also differential equations, boundary value problems, function analysis in general, differential geometry, even spectral geometry, and group theory, to name a few. Now, yeah, I'm going to list now a few of current research projects in sampling theory, and that's definitely incomplete. I'm just giving you what I came up with. There's no claim at completeness here. First of all, of course, find generalized sampling theorems. For example, to turn sums into integrals in more fancy ways. So that would be aiming at pure mathematics. On the other hand, very important for practical purposes in digital signal processing is to study the stability of the reconstruction of a continuous signal from its discrete samples in the presence of noise, or in the when you just lose some samples, which sometimes happens in practice, then what do you do? How do you best interpolate what you lost? Or if you have imprecise samples, if you don't sample if you don't take your samples for technical reasons at the right time, maybe you're a little bit offset from the point in time that you ought to have sampled. Maybe this one is shifted, this point is a little bit shifted to the left or so. How do you correct for that? Another topic that I've personally worked on is to use variable sample rates to adjust to varying bandwidth. See, if in general you might have a signal in which sometimes you have a violin playing very high notes, so you need a large bandwidth, and then on other occasions you don't need a high bandwidth, so you would like to reduce the sampling rate to economize on how many data you have to record. Of course, in this case, again, Fourier theory no longer suffices, and it turns out that in order to prove the generalized sampling theorem for this case, you need functional analysis. It turns out that you can rewrite the basic sampling theorem in terms of functional analysis, in terms of self-adjoint operators, more precisely in terms of the theory of self-adjoint extensions of symmetric operators, And when you write it in this way, then you're no longer restricted to discrete samples because you've liberated yourself from having to use Fourier theory. You see, the spectrum of a self-adjoint operator doesn't have to be equidistant, right? And it's the spectrum of a self-adjoint operator that determines the sampling points there. So you do a generalization of the sampling theorem, and that can then be applied to data compression. In fact, I have a patent on a data compression that's based on using functional analysis to derive a generalized sampling theorem. Well, and then sampling theory could also, or will also be, is also being considered, so far not very much, but I foresee that this is going to be a larger field. Sampling theory is also being considered on curved manifolds, Riemannian manifolds. On the one hand, what you can do with this is you can model a dinosaur skin, for example. But more practically, or well, that would be practical, I suppose, but perhaps more significant on a fundamental level, is that you can then really try to apply sampling theory on curved space and try to contribute to mathematical physics, to the question of, you know, is space-time discrete or continuous, or perhaps does space-time have the sampling property so that electric fields, magnetic fields can be reconstructed everywhere if you know them only at at sufficiently densely spaced points. And then you can start to calculate predictions for cosmology. What would you see, or what will you see, according to this assumption, if you increase the resolution with which you see the distribution of energy in the universe? This is this being the picture of the cosmic microwave background again. Now, this this study, the study of sampling theory and curved manifolds, which has been going on over the past 10, 15 years or so on a low level, but which has picked up over the past 3 years or so, involves rather beautiful mathematics. It involves a combination of functional analysis and differential geometry. The way you can see that, for those of you who are familiar with this concept, is that you need to find a generalization of the concept of bandwidth. See, bandwidth, naively, in a basic sampling theorem, is simply to say there are no frequencies above such and such. There's no wavelength shorter than so and so. Now, what would be the analog of that on a Riemannian manifold? Well, what you want to do is, of course, something covariant, something that's not coordinate system dependent. So what you can do is you can take the plus operator, you know that its spectrum is an invariant of the manifold, and then you chop off the spectrum of the Laplace operator. That gives you a subspace of your Hilbert space of, let's say, square integrable functions on that Riemannian manifold. And then you can go ahead and try to prove a sampling theorem for the remaining Hilbert space. In the case that you go back to the Riemannian manifold being just Euclidean, n-dimensional Euclidean space, you recover the basic sampling theorem again. But it's generalizing it to arbitrary dimensions and to the case with curvature as well. Well, and finally, I'd like to mention a topic that I haven't touched upon yet at all, which is that in the physics of information, a new field has come up over the past few years, which is attracting a lot of attention, and that's the field of quantum computing and quantum communication. Just to remind you of what the prospects of the field are, why there's so much excitement about it, well, on the one hand, the use of quantum theory in computers, so computers that make use of quantum effects, specifically make use of quantum effects, has been proven that if we can do that, if we can actually build those gadgets as mathematically, we have proven in principle is possible. If we can physically in a lab actually build those quantum computers, then they will allow us to gain an exponential speed up of some computations. And that includes in particular computations that are needed to break cryptographic codes. On the other hand, the field of quantum communication promises secured communication. For example, one bank can communicate with another bank and be sure that nobody listened into the communication. They don't even need to encrypt. They just know, they can find out whether somebody listened into the communication or not, using, again, a quantum effect. Those of you who have heard a little bit about quantum mechanics, you know that if you measure or observe a quantum system, then a process happens that is called the collapse of the wave function, which is a totally observable. That's something you can measure. Basically, that's what's being used here. If you send a quantum state from one bank to the other, then if an eavesdropper tries to interfere, he will collapse the wave function, and that can be worked out on statistical grounds by classical communication between the two parties. In fact, you can buy a gadget like that already. This is already on the market. I'm not sure whether you can really buy it, but there are companies that, startup companies that produce these things. The problem there is, though, that you can't do the communication very far. You can do it within Manhattan or within Toronto or so, but you can't do it across the Atlantic, and that's because you have to do with single photons that you send through a fiber optic wire. And a single photon is unlikely to make it across the Atlantic. It's going to be absorbed in the glass fiber. And it's going to make it over a few kilometers, but not over the Atlantic. Nobody knows how to overcome that problem yet. So what could be the role of sampling theory in this? Well, the focus of quantum information theory, quantum computing and quantum communication so far, has been virtually exclusively on discrete representations of information in terms of spins and so on. It's basically only half of information theory. It's a quantum version of only half of information theory. There's also the information theory of continuous sources of information, of continuous representations of information, and we don't really have a quantum theory of continuous representations of information, and it would be very neat if that could be developed for practical purposes, but also for just out of curiosity. And then, of course, what would be the link between the discrete and continuous case? Probably it would be sampling theory again. That has just not been established. It's just a new field. So let me summarize. What I want to say is that sampling theory is a bridge between discrete and continuous structures. It involves various interesting branches of mathematics. Of course, all of the branches are interesting, but what I want to say is that it connects them in interesting ways. And what I hope to have shown is that if one works on sampling theory, one has this exciting prospect that if you find a new result in sampling theory, it might have applications in various different fields without extra effort, right? Because the mathematics is in common between those fields. So you work on sampling theory and you find something that might be useful for building a quantum computer of all things, or it might be useful for digital audio, digital video, data compression, or radar. I haven't even talked about radar yet. And as we've seen, even in cosmology. Thank you.